Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video in which Lee Strobel, the author of The Case for Christ, gives a quick summary of what he thinks is the best evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. If you are unfamiliar with Lee Strobel, he is one of the Christian apologists of the "I used my professional skills to try and prove Christianity wrong and ended up becoming a Christian" variety. In my experience with this genre of apologist, I usually come away with a feeling that they either had other reasons for their converting that they know don't hold up to scrutiny quite as well, like personal experiences or emotional reasons, or else they weren't terribly good at their jobs, which supposedly gave them the skills to uncover the truth about events from 2,000 years ago. And as a minor technical note, for copyright reasons I had to remove music from this video. It turned out well, I think, but he does sound a bit overprocessed and there are a few spots where you can hear musical remnants. That's why. Anyway, let's see if Lee Strobel is any better than Wallace was.
I like to look at the evidence for the resurrection in four categories. The first one is, did Jesus die on the cross? Was he dead?
Really? Your first line of evidence is a question of whether some guy who existed 2,000 years ago died? Well, I am fully confident in saying that, yes, every person who was alive 2,000 years ago is currently dead. Now, I know this point is more about the method of death than the fact that he died. It's that he died on the cross. Well, I consider this to be such a mundane claim as to not even bother trying to fight against it. The idea that a guy could have been executed by the Romans in a way that the Romans were known to execute lots and lots of people, it's not really surprising at all.
Virtually every scholar on planet Earth concedes that Jesus was dead after crucifixion.
Why do you say concedes as if this is giving something up? Historians aren't trying to figure out other methods that Jesus could have died by. Historians agree that the crucifixion of Jesus was probably a real event, both Christian and secular historians. Yes, of course, there are mythicists out there, like Richard Carrier, who would argue that Jesus was not an historical figure to begin with, so for him the idea of a crucifixion in the first place would be a concession, but not the death part of it. The death part is pretty much assumed to be correct because we have no reason to believe otherwise. Like, if you got Richard Carrier to agree that Jesus maybe did exist, I don't think he would have a problem with dying on the crucifixion. You just have to convince him that the crucifixion happened in the first place.
We have no record of anyone anywhere ever surviving a full Roman crucifixion.
The word "full" is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence. Because we have an account written by Josephus where he recognized three of his former acquaintances while they were being crucified, so he begged the Roman general Titus to spare them. So they were taken down, and one of them survived.
Oh, now, we've got a couple of days up here. Plenty of time. Lots of people get rescued.
How does one differentiate between a full crucifixion and a non-full crucifixion, I wonder? I feel like the defining factor there would be whether or not the victim died, which would then make that sentence essentially be saying, we have no record of anyone who died by crucifixion surviving the crucifixion that killed them. Well, duh.
Even the Journal of the American Medical Association published a peer-reviewed scientific medical study of the evidence for the death of Jesus and said, clearly, the weight of the evidence indicates that Jesus was dead even before the wound to his side was inflicted.
Yes, that comes from a 1986 paper called On the Physical Death of Jesus Christ, and while I do agree with its conclusion that Jesus died, and while the purpose of the paper was essentially to ask the question of whether a person put in the situations described in the Bible could hypothetically survive, the paper's purpose was not to question the truth of what the Bible was saying surrounding the events leading up to Jesus' crucifixion. So it is worth mentioning that this is the context of the study, because they do essentially start with the assumption that the Bible is a perfectly accurate record of everything that happened leading up to the crucifixion. So if we take the Bible at its word, it is extremely unlikely for Jesus to have survived that ordeal. But we have no reason to just start with the assumption that the Bible can be taken at its word.
The second category of evidence is the early accounts we have for the resurrection.
Well, it'd have to be pretty significantly early, because we literally today have accounts of Hugo Chavez not only being alive 8 years after his death, but having had a significant impact on American politics in the 2020 election. Of course, if you take the time to fact-check this, you'll find that it originated with a statement from Trump's then-lawyer Sidney Powell, who didn't actually say that Hugo Chavez directly interfered in that specific election, but rather that the companies that made the American voting machines used software that was developed at the direction of Hugo Chavez when he was alive to ensure that he never lost an election in Venezuela. Now, the way she said it, it's still a patently absurd claim. But the fact that this is so easy to fact-check has not been able to stop the rumors of people's belief in a live Chavez messing with world politics, just 8 years after his death and just 8 months after the election he supposedly interfered with. So, if nothing else, these events demonstrate that untrue rumors can spread very quickly, even when they are easy to fact-check. Really, at the end of the day, if it can be historically demonstrated that the stories of Jesus' resurrection started circulating on the very day of his crucifixion, or rather the third day after it, I guess, that doesn't say anything about the truth of this claim. It's just a testament to how quickly rumors can spread.
In other words, I used to think as an atheist that the resurrection was a legend. And that took a long time to develop in the ancient world.
The resurrection itself doesn't have to have taken a long time to develop as a rumor. In fact, most atheists I know would be willing to agree that the belief in the resurrection was probably one of the first Christian beliefs to develop. The fact that people believe that Jesus had risen from the dead is likely the cause of the beginning of the religion. It's not much of a religion if it ends at the leader being executed by the authorities, but if some people somehow sincerely came to believe that this leader had in fact come back from the dead, then that's a fair bit more impressive than ending at the crucifixion, and it's more likely to spread just by virtue of the fact that it's a more interesting story, regardless of whether or not that story is true. It's kind of a self-selection mechanism.
But what I learned is that we have preserved for us a creed of the earliest Christian church. A creed that is a eyewitness-based report of the resurrection of Jesus.
Do we have any evidence that it's actually an eyewitness report? Because the creed itself, 1 Corinthians 15, for those of you unfamiliar, just essentially says, here's a bunch of people who saw Jesus. We don't know who originally wrote the creed or what their source was for the contents. All this can possibly tell us is that early Christians believed Christian beliefs. The Islamic creed, I bear witness that none deserves worship except God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of God, appears in the Quran, and there is evidence that it was a well-established Islamic creed in the same century in which the Quran was written. Does this have any bearing on whether or not it is true? Would it be more true if there were more evidence of it having been a creed at the time of its original authorship? Or is this rather just evidence of something that early Muslims believed? The statement early Christians believed Christian things is almost as unremarkable as the whole a guy who lived 2,000 years ago is dead now statement. Not quite, but almost.
Now, this creed has been dated back by scholars to within months of the death of Jesus.
Like I said, I don't care if it gets back to within days of his death. An unsourced statement that a bunch of people saw him alive once is not good evidence. After all, even today, when fact-checking is a piece of cake in comparison to first century Judea, we have people who, just months after the fact, believe that the US presidential election was stolen by Joe Biden, when that is demonstrably not true. In fact, it doesn't even matter for the purposes of this example whether or not you believe the election was stolen. If it was stolen, we have millions of people believing the myth that it was secure. If it was secure, then we have millions of people believing the myth that it was stolen. Either way, there are currently millions of people that believe something entirely mythical just months after the fact. And you want me to believe that it would be impossible for a few hundred people to have ended up believing a false rumor a few months after the fact? I don't think so.
Within months. That is historical gold. So we've got a newsflash from ancient history.
If it were actually attributed to someone rather than just being a statement of belief, then sure. But as it is simply a statement of belief. I believe that Jesus appeared to this list of people. Nothing more. Now, certainly from an historical perspective, this is interesting. It's always interesting to learn about the beliefs of regular people throughout history, but it doesn't say anything about the truth of those beliefs.
Third category of evidence is the empty tomb.
the empty tomb that nobody references until at least 30 years after the fact, and then it's not an eyewitness talking about an empty tomb, but at best a secondhand account about an unknown tomb being empty once? This is incredibly flimsy, if I'm generous. And this is being extra generous, going with the church tradition of Mark writing his account based on the teachings of Peter in Rome. There really isn't any evidence that this is what actually happened. In reality, Mark seems to have been a compilation of oral stories that were in circulation about Jesus at the time of his writing. Since there isn't even a hint of a tomb in any writings before Mark, much less of an empty one, we have no reason to believe that there even was a tomb. The most likely scenario, as confirmed by Christian scholars, is that a crucifixion victim would have had their body left on the cross to rot before being thrown into a mass grave. No mention of an empty tomb came up until it would be far too late for any sort of verification. Like, really? Hey, this empty tomb over here? Yeah, it had someone in it 30 years ago, and that's how you know that that person was raised from the dead. Would anyone take that seriously? Well, I mean, obviously they do, so point withdrawn, I guess. But that seems like bad epistemology to me.
And the best evidence for that is even the opponents of Jesus implicitly admitted the tomb was empty. Because when the disciples began proclaiming that Jesus had risen, what the opponents said was, the disciples stole the body.
Who said that? When was that said? I may be wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, the only account of anyone saying that the tomb was empty because of a stolen body comes from the book of Matthew, in an implausible tale about how a Roman guard at the tomb would have gone straight to the chief priests rather than to the Roman authorities to report a failure of their mission, at which point the non-Roman priests tell these Roman guards that they will protect them from the Roman authorities if they lie and admit to falling asleep at their posts, a crime that is punishable by death. How Jewish priests would possibly protect Roman guards from Roman punishments is left to the imagination, but one of the things that the priests tell the guards is to lie and say that the disciples stole the body, and this is the only record of any kind from history that talks about opponents of Jesus admitting that the tomb was empty, and it comes from a source that has a vested interest in providing an ad hoc explanation for certain details. It reads very much as Matthew adding in an apologetic explanation for the origin of the stolen body idea after the story had been in circulation for a while, and at least a few people thought to ask, how do we know the body wasn't just stolen? Matthew saying that the chief priest claimed the body was stolen sounds pretty much exactly like the classic apologist story of, that one time I was flying on an airplane and I sat next to an atheist professor who I stumped repeatedly with my amazingly clever questions. Not true is what I mean. It sounds not true.
Now they're conceding the tomb's empty, they're just trying to explain how it got empty. So everybody's conceding the tomb was empty.
I'm not. And I know a lot of other people who are not making such a concession. In fact, there are many who are not willing to grant the concession that there even was a tomb. A mass grave is the most likely historical scenario, in which case it is likely that Jesus' body would have been completely unrecognizable, and so nobody would be able to confirm whether or not he was in any particular grave, which means that the most likely scenario is that Jesus' body stayed put and the legend of the tomb showed up later.
How did it get empty is really the issue, and that goes to the fourth category of evidence, which is eyewitnesses.
Oh good, eyewitnesses! That should help at least establish that there was a tomb in the first place, right? Because so far, all we've got is an unsourced creedal statement that they believe that there were eyewitnesses, to the resurrection, not even to the tomb, followed by a guy who says that he was not an eyewitness, except he had that one vision that one time, and did not allow any eyewitness testimony to change what he was preaching, followed by the first accounts of Jesus' life, none of which even claims to be eyewitness testimony. None of this looks good so far, so let's see what you've got.
You know, for most of what we know about ancient history, it comes from one or maybe two sources of information.
It's never a good sign when your statement about how great your evidence is immediately followed up with a caveat about how bad other evidence can often be, rather than just a presentation of the evidence. Hey son, did you steal the cookies? I see chocolate smeared across your face. Well, Dad, you know that often when my brother eats cookies, he gets a lot more chocolate than me smeared across his face. And yes, I know that analogy is slightly backward. I like my stolen cookie analogies, don't at me.
And yet, for the conviction of the disciples that they encountered the resurrected Jesus, we have no fewer than 9 ancient sources, inside and outside the New Testament, confirming and corroborating the conviction of the disciples that they encountered the risen Christ.
I'd be interested in how you're counting those sources, because I'm aware of none that actually claim to be eyewitnesses, and only one, perhaps two if I'm generous, that claim to be secondhand reports of things that eyewitnesses have said. And actually, of those two, one is merely saying that the eyewitnesses existed and says nothing about what they may or may not have said. And eyewitness accounts outside the Bible? I mean, I guess if you're willing to give credibility to apocryphal texts that are known to have been authored much later than the canonical gospels, we might find some that actually claim to be written by eyewitnesses. But why would we take them at their word for that, but not for any of the other details that had them excluded from the final cut of the Bible? Or are you saying there's a Bible Snyder cut? But of course, he didn't say anything about having eyewitness accounts, but rather, nine accounts that confirm that the disciples believed that. So really, even if I grant that there are nine sources, all that means is that you found nine things like that passage from Tacitus, which essentially just says, hey, there's this group of people called Christians, here's a thing that they believe. And I think we all know that he's counting the four Gospels and the writings of Paul as five separate sources, which they're three if I'm generous. So all he needs here is four more sources outside the Bible to get to his inflated nine number. We can be reasonably sure that he would include Josephus and Tacitus on that list, as most apologists do, but who else would he use? Pliny the Younger, perhaps? He gave a brief description of Christians and some of their beliefs, and is often held up as confirming the life of Jesus, despite his writings doing no such thing. Maybe Mara Bar Serapion, who made a passing mention of the Jews executing their wise king, and connected that to the siege of Jerusalem, claiming that that was God's retribution for the execution of this wise king? I don't know, there's a bunch of non-biblical passing mentions of Jesus, but they all suffer from the fact that they don't actually confirm anything about Jesus, just what people believed about him. And most don't even go so far as to say that the disciples encountered a risen Christ, as you're saying here.
That is an avalanche of historical data.
It's really not, though. Like, I'm gonna be honest with you, I used the website that J. Warner Wallace bragged was the most visited page on his entire site in a segment of his video that I skipped when I covered it. That's where I'm getting my information on non-Christian corroboration for biblical details, from a biased source that wants to make it look as convincing as possible. And the first quotation that he lists on that site is from an historian named Thallus, as quoted by the 3rd century Christian historian Julius Africanus. Basically, Africanus reiterates the description of events surrounding Jesus' death, the ones that can only be found in Matthew, minus the Jerusalem zombies, of course, and then says, "This darkness, Thallus, in the third book of his history, calls, as appears to me without reason, an eclipse of the sun." So, with an incredibly generous interpretation of this passage, we can conclude that Thallus mentioned an eclipse that happened specifically at the time of Jesus' death, from which Wallace extrapolates that this verified that Jesus lived, was crucified, and that there was an earthquake and darkness at the point of his crucifixion. Which is not what Africanus claimed that Thallus said at all. Just the eclipse can be corroborated here, and even that can only be corroborated with an overly generous interpretation of the writing. So given that this seems to be the best that apologists can come up with consistently, I'm not terribly impressed.
So you put all that together and you have a really good case for Easter.
No, the really good case for Easter is that we celebrate Easter every year. If you want the case for the events behind Easter, though, you're gonna have to do better than Jesus died, 1 Corinthians 15, a tomb that is claimed to be empty at least 30 years after it's too late to check, and an appeal to historical corroboration that you leave unsourced. And when I look for the sources myself, it's, like, literally nothing. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Andrew Oning, who says, "I think the referrals to the Iliad are talking about the historicity of Homer, not the events in the story. This was on my video responding to the 700 Club, in which they asserted that historians don't question the authenticity of the Iliad, but they do question the authenticity of the Bible. They heavily implied that they were questioning the authenticity of the events recorded in the books, but if you're right and they were actually talking about the authors, then they're worse off than they would have been with their point as I took it, because there is a legitimate question of whether or not Homer actually existed. All that's really known about him is that the ancient Greeks attributed the Odyssey and the Iliad to him, and that's basically it. Which, granted, is actually a lot more than we know about the author of the Gospels. At least Homer had a name." Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Mark McManus, Mark Hetchum, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the bodies who were stolen from the tomb that is my channel. If you'd like to have your death start a religion, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time!